I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and it's great to have you with us. On Wednesday, the United States reached a grim milestone. 144,000 new coronavirus cases have been recorded across the country. Hospitalizations are at an all-time high, with many full to capacity, and more than 1,800 Americans died on that day alone. The COVID-19 crisis is officially worse than it has ever been in the United States, and governors nationwide are sounding the alarm.
Across the state, the majority of our regions are seeing far higher rates of hospitalizations for COVID-19 than they ever did last spring. In Southern Illinois, Region 5 has more than doubled.
I've signed Executive Order 94 advising Wisconsinites to stay home to save lives.
Primary goals continue to be keeping our hospitals from overflowing and stopping more Marylanders from dying. The capacity for indoor operations at bars and restaurants will be reduced from 75% back to 50%.
You look at the line, you look at the trajectory, you know where it's going. It is going up.
That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who announced a curfew on restaurants and bars and a 10-person limit to indoor and outdoor gatherings at personal residences. The state of New Jersey has also set similar rules into action. And over in El Paso, Texas, things have gone from bad to worse fast.
A few weeks ago, most El Pasoans probably didn't know anybody that had COVID. And then slowly but surely, we all knew 10 or 15 people who had COVID. Then slowly, we all knew 5 or 6 people who were in the hospital. And now, day after day, we all know somebody who's dying.
That's Bob Moore, the CEO of El Paso Matters, a nonprofit news organization in El Paso, Texas.
Our crisis really began to build at the beginning of October and has just snowballed since then. And for the past week, we've had more than 1,000 people hospitalized in El Paso. That's a higher number than most states have right now. We're beginning to see a familiar path here that, you know, several weeks after the case counts go up and a couple weeks after the hospitalization counts go up, we begin to see deaths increasing very rapidly. And what's happened here in El Paso is that the county has had to bring in 10 temporary morgues to be able to handle the deaths. It's just absolutely heartbreaking to watch what's going on.
And just as we saw in states across the country earlier in the pandemic, there's been lots of infighting between local officials in El Paso, with the county judge and the mayor at odds over whether to have a shutdown in place at all. It's good to remember, as Bob pointed out to us, that in May, the city of El Paso made a decision to stop enforcing public health orders and educate people instead. And Bob says that's only worsened the situation for the community along the border.
It's a predominantly Latino community, and 90%+ of the people who are getting sick and dying in this community are Latino. This virus is disproportionately affecting communities of color. The virus didn't create these societal divides that we're seeing, but it has exacerbated them and it has exposed them.
I'm joined now by Ed Yong, a science writer at The Atlantic, and Dr. Howard Koh, former Assistant Secretary for Health in the Obama administration and a professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Ed, why are we seeing a rise in COVID-19 infections so recently?
I think it's somewhat inevitable. The Trump administration has been woefully negligent in its handling of this pandemic. We still lack a coordinated, workable federal strategy to deal with this virus, which really ought to be controllable. As you've heard already, lots of options for people to get infected. Indoor spaces like bars and restaurants and gyms, where the virus very readily transmits between people in close, prolonged proximity. Many of them are fully open around the country. People have traveled. Universities are open, have opened. So students are going there, getting infected, taking the virus back to their local communities. And pandemic fatigue has set in, where people just seem to have habituated to the horror of COVID-19, the fact that there are so many infections and deaths happening on a daily basis. seems to just to become part of the ambient background of our lives. Another unacceptable thing that America has come to accept.
And yet, Ed, we're hearing from, particularly we heard from Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, at the opening of this segment here. But there are other folks, even in New Jersey and other states, that are saying, let's just close a little earlier. We'll close bars and restaurants a little earlier, gyms a little earlier. I mean, to me, that doesn't feel like it's going to have any wide-ranging effect. What are your thoughts on some of the measures that states have taken so far?
Yeah, they're half-hearted and they're ridiculous. What is a 10 p.m. curfew going to do? It's not like the virus only comes out at 10:01 p.m. You know, there are all those hours where people are still huddling together in bars and restaurants when they're in close contact, where they're talking loudly at each other in indoor spaces. We know that these are the conditions in which COVID most easily transmits. So you can't expect to keep those conditions in place and not have the kinds of surges that we are seeing right now.
Dr. Koh, what are medical professionals facing right now as the country continues to battle this pandemic and the increasing rates of infection?
So, Tanzina, it's fair to say that we're in the most dire chapter of this pandemic response, 10 months and counting now, unfortunately. And you reviewed so nicely, all the trends are going in absolutely the wrong direction, shattering records for new cases, hospitals being overwhelmed, test positivity going up around the country. And we're getting to the situation, Tanzina, where people usually assume that if they are sick, they can go to a nearby hospital and get a bed and have a medical team taking care of them in the way they need and deserve. But that's not the case anymore in too many parts of the country. You've cited some examples in places like Wisconsin and Texas, and we're hearing about field hospitals being erected in Massachusetts here, the mobile morgues that are being established as well. So this is a time where we need to really rally and double down on prevention and public health as much as possible until a vaccine comes. And this is also in the flu season, where we need to maximize prevention there, make sure that everybody's getting their flu shot, because this could get worse before it gets better.
Dr. Koh, we've spoken to a number of medical professionals on the show during this pandemic, and I'm wondering if you're hearing from them that they have largely what they need, are personal protective equipment and other ventilators and other things that they need to get through this, and how some of them may be feeling right now. Are there concerns about their own public health and safety?
So our frontline healthcare workers have been absolute heroes for months now. And we all knew that with the fall and winter coming, that this would be a very difficult time for us and for the pandemic. But it's very troubling to hear that issues of PPE shortages and supply shortages are arising yet again. There's some concerns whether the national stockpile has enough N95 masks to carry the system forward. So we have to, with the new administration coming on, make sure that there's a national plan, a national effort, coordinating information about what we have and what we will need in the future, and make sure that we have a one government approach. One of the many challenges, Tanzania, that we've had in the months of this pandemic response is we have not had federal, state, and local leaders working together. This is a time we have to do it. And the president-elect, in fact, has appointed a new task force to try to help us get to that very important goal.
Ed, I'm wondering your thoughts, because there were some stories this week that we've heard of measures that some states are taking in the face of shortages of medical staff in particular. North Dakota, for example, said it would allow asymptomatic workers with COVID-19 to keep working. What else are we seeing in terms of the drastic measures that are needed right now?
Actually, just finished reporting and writing a piece on this, which should be out soon. I've been spending a lot of time talking to healthcare workers on the front lines, and I really cannot overstate how bad the situation is for them. So COVID patients are among the sickest people that many healthcare workers have ever treated. Like a typical ICU nurse can deal with two patients at a time, but a COVID patient requires their full attention. So you're halving the amount of care of people that an ICU nurse can care for. Those people are also in the ICU for three times as long. And also a ton of those nurses and other healthcare workers are coming down with the virus themselves. They're taking time off sick. So the healthcare workforce is so stretched and so exhausted. One of the problems with this surge is that it has hit so many different parts of the country that, unlike previous surges where, say, New York could seek help from other states or the South could seek help from other states, there aren't reinforcements coming. There's no one has any reinforcements to send because everyone is completely slammed. So what are you going to do then? You could try and send patients to a different hospital, but all the other hospitals are slammed too. So the more the virus moves, the less healthcare workers can move and the more stretched and exhausted and burnt out they become. I'm really, really worried about the situation for the people who are trying to save everyone's lives right now.
Dr. Koh, to that point, I mean, the CDC has issued back and forth guidance since the beginning of this pandemic. But one thing that's remained clear is the importance of masks. Americans, many are wearing them. Some have chosen not to. But Dr. Koh, how much of this is a lack of media coverage on the pandemic itself? How much of it is a lack of daily briefings, for example, from the president? Just in terms of the fact that it feels like a lot of Americans aren't getting it, that we are still in the middle of a massive pandemic.
Well, that's a great question, Tanzina. In the midst of the worst health crisis our country has faced in a century, we need daily communications from our top leaders, from the White House. And those health messages have to be consistent. One of the troubling issues of the response so far is that the messages have been so mixed. The messages have been so consistently inconsistent, and it's sowed so much confusion. Around masks, for example, we need universal mask usage as one nation. We need a united mask effort for the United States. And here we are 10 months and counting into the pandemic response, and we still don't have that. Now, more and more data has shown that this is very effective in terms of prevention, not only for others, but for the wearer himself or herself. And so in a time where people are literally drowning in a rising pool of infection, wearing a mask is a way to turn that faucet off. And that's got to be the single message going forward, because everybody can still make a contribution on bringing all these cases back down before a vaccine comes forward.
Dr. Koh, let's turn to vaccine news. Early data from Pfizer shows that there is a vaccine that they're developing that they say is 90% effective. What does that mean?
Well, we're very encouraged by this preliminary news, Tanzina. People may know that there are five vaccine candidates that are going through these final phase three trials. So this opening news from Pfizer a couple days ago suggests that this one candidate from their company can prevent infection for about 90% of people. So that's very encouraging. We have to stress that these results are very preliminary. It came out in a news release, so we need to see the data. We need to make sure that independent scientific experts are looking at that data carefully while the trial is completed. We have to also track the safety profile and make sure this is not only effective but safe. But if those barriers can be overcome and we can cross the finish line with that one vaccine candidate, people are hopeful that this could be distributed perhaps by the end of this year. Now, of course, we should stress that this is a vaccine that needs two doses, so that represents a challenge for distribution and dissemination. There's some cold storage issues that we can get into as well. But we are hopeful that if this one candidate crosses the finish line and there are at least another or two more, we could be able to make these widely available for the American public by the beginning of next year.
And of course, Dr. Koh, there have been some mutations of the virus. Does that mean that we will have to expect and wait for other vaccines, or will this be something that will look maybe like the flu vaccine, which is updated annually, depending on the strains that are out there?
Well, we're very grateful to the basic scientists who are tracking the mutations that are being increasingly described. We do not have evidence yet that mutations lead to a virus that's more dangerous. Um, all, although we have seen now evidence of mutations, for example, in Denmark in the mink population. I think the global community is following that carefully. We also do not see evidence that mutations make vaccines less effective. So we have to track all this going forward, follow the basic science as well as the public health implications, and make sure that people get the vaccines and the prevention they need and deserve.
Ed, I'm wondering if some of this, the news of a potential vaccine, the fact that, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of folks are learning to live with this virus as part of our daily lives. Some people are wearing masks, others may not. But it doesn't feel, at least not here in New York and around, that there is a crisis level concern right now. How do we get more engagement from the public in terms of this issue?
I actually don't know, and I have a possible answer, but I don't think it's one that I really like, which is I just think that unless people really see the scope of what this disease can do, you know, the horrors of the next couple of months firsthand, I'm just not sure how we shake ourselves out of the apathy that we have slipped into. And
as a journalist, though, do you think it's our job as journalists to be keeping the spotlight on this, to be giving those types of reports that are really telling the story? Are we doing
absolutely.
Enough?
Absolutely. You know, I think that we our entire profession is geared towards the news. We want things that are novel. But the problem is that a pandemic is a long-running marathon of a crisis. And the types of advice that we are trying to give to people, the issues that we're trying to spotlight, are the same as they were in March and in the summer, largely. You know, the messages haven't changed. But because we are looking for the new, for the bright, shiny object on the horizon, I think it's hard to think to get into this habit of just saying the same things again and again. I struggle to find like new ways of saying the same messages to people who are tired and worn out with them.
Dr. Koh, to that point, I think there are people who might be saying, okay, we can live with the virus. I'll wear a mask if I have to, but I probably won't die from the coronavirus. And that feels like it's somewhat limited because you could also get sick. And we've heard of COVID long haulers. What would you like to tell our audience about the long-term effects of COVID-19 if you survive the virus?
Well, this is another dimension of this terrible pandemic that we're understanding as scientists and as health professionals. There are growing numbers of people who get COVID and then they have chronic long-term sequelae. They have heart damage, lung damage, brain damage, neuromuscular problems. So this is a challenge that we all need to take so seriously. And back to the response that Ed gave, and I could add to this, is that as a physician, I've learned from caring for patients for years that when a loved one dies, that's a tragedy. But when a loved one dies and you know that death could have been prevented, that's a tragedy that haunts you forever. So we are seeing that theme playing over and over again now in our country, and we can do something about it. We have to understand that our health is a gift, and it's precious, and it's fragile. And that's where the power of prevention is absolutely critical, especially during this flu season, through the holiday season coming up, and as the winter approaches.
Lots of folks are thinking about holidays and the cold winter months, but is the recommendation that you have as a physician still the same? Wear masks, wash your hands, stay home?
Absolutely. And, you know, we want people to enjoy the holidays, but this holiday has got to be different from any other. The number of attendees in any holiday celebration has to be at the absolute minimum, with great respect for who is at risk, particularly older loved ones and relatives. And so the CDC has put out new guidance yesterday on this that everybody should look at, but we should apply these principles, protect our loved ones, keep the gatherings to the lowest number possible, and get through this so that we can have a brighter day in the future.
And bigger Thanksgiving next year. Dr. Howard Koh is the former Assistant Secretary for Health at the Obama administration and from the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard. And Ed Yong is a science writer at The Atlantic. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
And as As we just heard, the coronavirus pandemic is exploding to unprecedented levels around the country. And with the holidays quickly approaching, that means people will need to decide if and how to safely celebrate with their loved ones. Public health experts agree that the safest Thanksgiving this year is one where we don't leave home. So where does that put us? Eating turkey together on Zoom? Well, what about beyond the holidays? How do we adapt our lives for what potentially could be a dark COVID winter? Here to talk us through all this is Rachel Miller, the deputy editor of Vice Life and the author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and Your People. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So difficult times right now, on top of difficult times, it's the holidays are quickly approaching and some folks are having some awkward conversations with their family about not to attend holiday celebrations. How do you suggest approaching those conversations?
Well, I think the first thing to do is, if you're the one who is deciding not to go home like you normally would, or you're the one kind of requesting the change of plans, I think it's really important to give yourself permission first, because it can feel really hard to have these conversations if you're not confident in what you're saying, or, you know, if your partner is the one pushing for it, it can be easy to kind of throw them under the bus versus owning your decisions. So I think it's important to think through why you're doing this and to feel really good about the choice you're making. Even if you don't feel good about it in the sense of it's not a positive thing, you're not happy about it, you should at least try to feel confident in it so that you can approach the conversation from a more grounded place and just not get sort of overwhelmed if you get a lot of pushback.
And imagine some of the pushback and some of the hard feelings around this are because the holidays are usually a time when we get to see people and we get to connect with people, and we haven't been able to do that in so long, and so many of us have been relegated to these Zoom calls or FaceTime calls. Are there any other creative alternatives to an in-person holiday gathering other than eating turkey in front of a Zoom?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it really depends on your family and the traditions that you all love the most. I think figuring out how to replicate those is really important, and also talking to your family about what they're going to miss most and figure out how you can do that. So if they, you know, love taking a big family photo every year, is there a way that you can replicate that outside? I edited a piece from a freelancer who suggested doing a Zoom cooking lesson with a family member who always makes the beloved favorite recipe, have them teach everyone how to make it over Zoom and walk you through all the steps so you're seeing them make it themselves. You can record it so you all have that as a keepsake. Those are the things that make you feel more connected, maybe even more so than actually eating the meal together. It's being in the kitchen together. So figuring out what things are going to feel really special and memorable. And, you know, sometimes imitating the former thing can feel worse. So it can feel strange to have a holiday with only 4 people there instead of 20. So if you're going to be upset by that, maybe it's time to do something entirely different and not make the traditional meal, have an entirely different menu so you don't feel that sense of sadness because this just can't hold a candle to past years. So I think finding something else to get excited about helps a lot.
Of course, public health experts are recommending not to have gatherings this holiday season, but there may be folks who insist on doing it anyway, even if you yourself are not going to attend. Is it worth trying to change their minds, sending them articles and saying, look at this, or is that just not helpful?
I think it's worth having a conversation about it because I think you'll feel better if you say your piece. But I do think it's important to go into it with the understanding that, you know, your relatives are their own people. They have agency, that your grandparents aren't sweet little old people who are being conned necessarily. They are adults who can make decisions for themselves. And I think it's important to treat them as such versus kind of condescending them and coming in with all these facts and data, which might not actually move them. And I think that's a really hard thing to recognize, that the holidays are super emotional, super fraught. So what is the more emotional argument to make here? How can you say to them, you know, I'm really worried that if we gather, I won't be able to relax and enjoy myself and have a good time because I'm going to be worried about getting you sick and potentially killing you. Like, maybe you need to put it in terms of like, I'm really scared about you and your health or my own health, or frame it in that lens versus just like, these are the statistics that I think a lot of people tend to tune out. Meet them where they are and talk to them in a way that they will relate to more.
Rachel, some folks will not have family to gather with. Some folks live alone. We know that a lot of Americans live alone increasingly. How are people who live alone going to manage this holiday season, which is really, you know, the past couple of months have really shown a light on isolation in particular?
Yeah, it's very real and it's really difficult. So I actually have a lot of experience with this. This will be my first Christmas not alone, I think, since 2014. And so I've sort of mastered how to be alone on Christmas. And I think it's really important to have a plan going into it. If you wait until Christmas Eve to start making plans, you're going to realize, oh, I can't go to the grocery store and get food and I don't have any activities and maybe I would have done laundry. So plan ahead, don't wait. And I think it's important to do something, even if it's not something related to the holiday. If you decide I'm going to watch movies all day and pretend this isn't happening, totally fine, but just know going into it what you're going to do. I think it's helpful to have, like, make a special meal, to have a recipe that you've picked out. Doesn't have to be a holiday recipe. I would always make this lasagna soup, which takes a few hours, feels really special and fancy, isn't really Christmassy, but always made me feel, you know, a little bit more festive and gave me something to do. I think that was a really important thing. Another small thing I'd always do is wait to open any gifts I received until Christmas morning. So if I got packages in the mail, I would just put them under the tree. And then be sure to reach out to people. Like, you don't have to be alone. You should, you know, check in with a couple of friends, just because they're going to be worried about you too. It's a strange day. And let yourself be sad if you're feeling sad. Like, this is a rough year. You don't have to be excited about it. And it can feel bad to be alone on a big holiday, but know that you are not alone in the sense that a lot of other people are going through this too and have gone through it in the past. And don't feel shame about it, because it is a more common experience than I think people realize, and it will definitely be common this year. So trust that you will get through it. It's just a single day. That's the other thing I think can be hard to remember. It's just that one day, and then life does sort of resume and you will have gotten through it by the end of it.
Of course, there's also this idea that, you know, being indoors is not ideal, which is the reason why we're having this conversation. Largely, a lot of our activities take place indoors in the colder months, but we're going outdoors more. And are there any alternatives there? Are there any ideas that you have for folks to socialize safely in the winter, but outside?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we can do is do our best to get warm boots, socks, gloves. If you don't have a real winter jacket with a good hood, now is the time. So I think investing in things that are going to make it easier to be comfortable outdoors, get in the habit of checking the weather, and understand that, like, maybe for a little while, you're only going to be able to see people you care about, you know, once a week on a masked walk, bundled up, and it's going to be at a time when the sun is shining, so, and there's no wind. Like, that might be the best we can do for a couple of months, and it's not ideal, but it's better than nothing. It's probably better than a Zoom call, and it's also better than getting sick. So I think be willing to make some compromises and then get creative. Like, can you get an outdoor space heater? Can you, you know, can somebody build a fire that you can gather around? Like, again, these options kind of vary depending on where you live and what access you have. But thinking about what are small things that I can do to be able to connect on some level with people. And I think outdoor activities like snowshoeing and cross-country skiing and ice skating are also going to be big this winter. So if you've never done it before, maybe let yourself embrace it and try things like that. Just be willing to step outside your comfort zone a little bit in order to not isolate yourself.
Holidays are hard for a lot of folks generally. And as you said, this has been a particularly difficult year for so many Americans. And I think, you know, it's going to be a difficult time for people, whether they have people with them or not. This has been a year full of a lot of loss and a lot of difficult moments. So if people are feeling lonely, overwhelmed, anxious, not just for the holidays, but with seasonal issues as far as the winter and the colder months, how should they navigate some of that in this time?
I think one thing to do is to use the time right now before it gets worse, before it gets darker, to prepare yourself both physically, emotionally, prepare your home because you're going to be inside for a while. So doing little things, whether that's like creating a more comfortable workspace so you can work from home during the day, or starting a workout routine, or just going for a walk every day so you have something in place that kind of gets you up and moving, getting your flu shot, getting a thermometer and a box of tissues and cold medicine so you have the essentials in place should you need them. I think that really can put your mind at ease. Then I think also just reaching out to people and letting them know, hey, I'm really nervous about, you know, not seeing you anymore this winter. Can we set up a weekly Zoom hangout? Or would it be okay if I gave you a call sometimes when I'm feeling lonely? I think people are feeling it, and it can feel really scary to reach out and to be honest about that. But now more than ever, people understand. And I think, you know, being willing to be a little bit vulnerable and put yourself out there and ask for help when you need it. Like, people want to help. They want to be there for their friends. They're worried. So reach out. Don't feel like you have to suffer in silence, or that people don't care about you or don't have time for you. Like, we're all in this together. And I think everyone's really looking for ways that they can support their loved ones and their friends.
Rachel Miller is the deputy editor of Vice Life and the author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and Your People. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
On this week's On the Media, what happened to the offbeat, irreverent, speaking truth to power alt-weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country?
The Voice was their guide to life from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
The end of an era on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Since the start of his presidential campaign in 2015, Donald Trump has sought to discredit and foster mistrust in the media, weaponizing phrases like
fake news
and positioning the media, in his words, as
the enemy of the people.
And that rhetoric has had an effect on how many Americans feel about the media they consume. And it should be no surprise that research shows those divisions fall along party lines. According to a September Gallup poll, 73% of Democrats said they trusted the media, compared to just 36% of independents and 10% of Republicans. As Donald Trump nears the end of his time in office, media outlets will need to reassess how they cover the White House going forward and how to rebuild trust with the public. I'm now with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, great to have you with us.
Pleasure to join you.
And Alex Neeson, staff writer for the Columbia Journalism Review. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
Let's start with you, Alex. How would you assess the media's coverage of Donald Trump, at least since the election and his claims that the election has been stolen? How well have outlets pushed back on those claims?
You know, I think what I've seen in the last couple of weeks especially is a press that feels emboldened to really aggressively push back on these completely false claims that an election's been stolen or that there's been widespread voter fraud in some of these key states across the country. We've seen reporters call up election officials and talk to folks who are on the ground, poll workers, who have been actually doing the literal counting of the votes. And there's been absolutely no evidence. And I think there's been an aggression that I haven't always seen in covering Trump over the last 4 years. And I think it's sort of, the magic of the end of an administration where folks are feeling more confident. The election's been officially called. And so now people can focus their efforts on saying, here are the things that the Trump administration is saying, and here's why we know that they're not true.
David, I want to dig into that point because I've agree with Alex. I've noticed a lot more of the press being a lot more aggressive, but being aggressive now and being emboldened now is a little late, I would suggest. The president is, at least in the rest of the country's minds, on his way out. But they weren't as aggressive during his presidency. Would you agree?
I think it depends at what moment you're looking and at what institutions you're looking. As you well know, the media is not, the media can act in a herd, but the media is not a single organism, right? And I think there are moments where the media was very aggressive. I think you saw that from the New York Times. I think you saw that from the Washington Post, particularly in terms of investigative reporting. I think you saw that from CNN doing more in investigative reporting and in its tone, giving a lot of latitude to hosts and anchors to offer voice, as well as having, if you think of Jim Acosta as kind of a more pugilistic or bombastic tone from the White House. When you say enough, I think there were moments where the media it allowed itself to be overwhelmed by the administration, by its antagonism, by the cutting off of flows of authoritative information from an incredible array of government agencies and outlets, and also by just the sheer amount of misinformation and untrue claims and at times lies put out by the administration. I think that the press was overwhelmed. So there are moments I'd point to where I think the press did great, and there are a lot of moments where I think the press wasn't up to the task. Part of what you have to think about in this moment is, even if all that you feel is the case, which may be, what do you want the press to do right now? Because this is the essence of democracy, right? Is the peaceful handing over of power and authority in government. This is the moment. This is the total crux. And if the press can't do it now, then the press is not in the business of holding the powerful accountable. And I think that you are seeing, some missteps in tone, perhaps some moments at which the president's claims could be evaluated more aggressively. But by and large, I think they are saying, even from Mother Jones to the Associated Press to Fox News, you're having journalists step forward and saying these claims are not true. and we can't find any evidence to support them. And the president-elect at the moment is Joe Biden. That hasn't been officially sanctioned. The calling him that is not something that the Electoral College has yet convened to endorse, but it is clear that that is the case, and the country is right to function with that understanding.
Alex, given that analysis, which I think is also very accurate, I also think there are times when the press didn't have it together. And during this administration, particularly when it came to calling out, calling the things that the president would say that weren't true, calling them lies directly, or using the word racist or racism to describe certain things. Do you think that that's improved, Alex?
You know, sometimes I think it's a little hard to say. I think on the use of the word lie, that's something that we started having conversations about very early in the Trump administration. And there was a lot of discussion about whether it's our role to call something a lie, and whether a lie requires intent, and can we prove intent? And is it our job to do that even? I can't really recall off the top of my head any significant examples of us having come to consensus around the word lie, or having it being used in, you know, major headlines on significant stories. And on the word racist, that's a conversation that we've been having in the press since long before Trump, I think. Particularly internally, Black journalists and other journalists of color, I think, have been really pressuring their own outlets to be more accurate in our language, right? To say if a thing is racist, we can call it racist. This is not a matter of opinion. This is a factual determination that we can make, right? And I'm not, you know, on the question of have we done it better 4 years later, I don't really think so on the topic of calling things racist. I think certainly there are some examples. David mentioned where there's been really aggressive investigative reporting on the Donald Trump himself and his associates. And I think certainly there are some examples that you could find in different outlets where perhaps the word has been used. But I still think that we are overall as an industry heavily reliant on these euphemisms, racially tinged, racially charged, not just in describing things that have been done and said by the Trump administration, but also in our reporting on police brutality, in protests that spring up as a result of police brutality. I still think that there's this hesitancy for us to use to be very clear in our language and to call a racist thing racist.
David, remind us again, we talk a lot about President Trump, but presidential administrations in general have a very interesting relationship with reporters. Remind us what the Obama administration's relationship was like with the media.
You know, President Obama promised to be the most transparent, to run the most transparent administration in American history. And I think from the folks whom I talked to midway through his term, and again at the end, they'd say they'd give him mixed marks. But, you know, I think a big blot on his record was the use of essentially a version of the Espionage Act, which is 100 years old, to try to go after sources of reporters, and at times use reporters to do that, and at times even target reporters in that kind of investigation. Eric Holder, as Attorney General, was kind of aggressive about that. And partly that's ascribed to the age we live in, where because so much of communications aren't done, you know, in the bottom floor of a suburban parking lot, like Deep Throat was said to have done in Watergate, or you know, somebody dropping a report underneath the bottom of a park bench, as one might have done, but instead done through Signal or through texting or through emails or the like. There's now the ability to find these things out. There are digital footprints. And so suddenly, even prosecutors who may work underneath an attorney general who's interested in rooting out sources who in the past were saying, gosh, boss, it's hard for us to figure it out, they don't have that anymore. And so the folks I've talked to in law enforcement and in the media say it's a lot easier for this to be tracked down. And you're seeing a lot more action. Bush did a little bit of that. Obama really did. And Obama would be upset by coverage in the media. And there were times where, God knows, Obama had cause. If you think about the indulgence of the birther lie, which really helped to elevate Trump to national prominence as a question of a political figure, The press indulged that for far too long. Now, CNN and the Associated Press finally sent people to, you know, I believe Indonesia to see the truth about these claims about madrasas. That is where Obama was schooled as a boy when he was living abroad with his mother and his stepfather. You know, and the birther lie was ultimately tracked down and reported on as well in Hawaii. But, you know, that was indulged and given time, you know, in the way that certain elements of the conservative press give time for the debate over climate change, when it was very clear there were not two sides to this story. And so I think Obama, you know, this morning, there's little excerpts out of Obama's first part of Obama's memoirs. And he said he sent Joe Biden to negotiate with Congress in part because he thought McConnell would do that, and that really conservative Republicans would talk to Biden more than to Obama himself. Why? Well, it wasn't this Kenyan, it wasn't this Muslim Obama. You know, he basically used the claims about him to characterize himself, to talk about how he was thinking about politics. Well, that was reflected a lot, particularly in the conservative press and places like Fox News, in ways that were not only upsetting to Obama, but also you know, would knock him off course, would make him talk about things that weren't part of his priorities or part of really helpful national politics. If you look at the amount of attention on Benghazi, similarly, it's not right. that tragedy and that terrible incident doesn't deserve coverage, scrutiny, and investigation. It's that the amount of it for what happened and what appears to have been yielded even by his strongest political foes didn't match up with the heat that you saw in a lot of the press.
And yet President Trump has a very different approach there. When he sees news that he does not like, he tweets about it. He directly goes to his audience. Alex, how do you think that has defined this Trump presidency and its relationship with the public, or at least how the public sees the media when the president has come out and, you know, tweets about things that he doesn't like or calls us the enemy of the people?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the notable differences is that when a piece of reporting comes out and the president doesn't like it, and he goes on Twitter to talk to his followers about it and to sort of express his distaste for it, he's not presenting you know, evidence for it to back up any of his claims that the reporting is false. He just doesn't like it. And so he goes on the internet and he says that. And there's this sort of cult of celebrity around him that encourages his followers to not look for evidence. They don't need the evidence. All that matters is that their president doesn't like it and says it's fake. And so it's fake. And I think that has presented a problem for reporters who are so used to relying on fact and presenting fact and then, you know, having that be the end of the conversation. You know, we present the evidence speaks for itself, and then we're ready to move on. And Donald Trump says, oh, no, you know, this is fake because I say it's fake. And there's a whole awful lot of people who accept that. And so I think that, you know, we spent the last 4 years like in a washing machine, just sort of tumbling around trying to get our footing in all of that. And I think it has led to us sometimes, you know, spending inordinate amounts of time trying to refute his claims that we've already refuted. And it just it becomes this cycle where, you know, the president says it's fake and we say, no, it's not. Here's the evidence. And we're just around and around and around. And it sort of never ends.
David, one of the most interesting things about this current moment is that trust in the media, as we've seen, particularly among party lines, is very, very, very low. What's the long-term implication of that?
Well, I think in some ways you're seeing Trump turn the press even more explicitly into one of these things in which there are partisan divides. Look, there's been a 50 plus year attempt, particularly by the Republicans, to discredit or undermine the standing of the media. It's been embraced with varying degrees of fervor. You know, George H.W. Bush pretended, you know, there were people around George W. Bush who did that. But really, there's been nothing like what we've seen on Trump since Richard Nixon. And I think Trump, even worse, is trying to undermine the ability of the press to stand up and offer authoritative versions of the facts that people then can argue about and people can then decide what they want to do about. I mean, we're supposed to be informing people so that they can act as engaged citizens, not simply to push out information to consumers. And I think he's sought to undermine the press, just as he sought to undermine, you know, weirdly, NOAA and the National Weather Services and the National Institutes of Health and the CDC as independent sources of information. I think, you know, in many ways, the idea, as we've heard today, the idea that he can offer that people can offer things that are critical of him, and that that is in and of itself false, is what he's trying to imprint people's mind, and different people are going to respond differently to that.
David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent, and Alex Neeson is a staff writer at the Columbia Journalism Review. Thanks to you both.
You bet.
Thanks so much.
All right, everybody, that's all for me this week. Amy Walter and the politics team will be with you tomorrow. Thanks, as always, for listening. And of course, we have to give a shout out to the crew that makes this show as amazing as it is. Our producer crew is led by Alexandra Botee and includes Meg Dalton, Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. David Gable is our executive assistant. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. And Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer and board op. Jackie Martin is our line producer. And Lee Hill is our executive producer. And we love to hear from you, so keep continuing to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.